Back to the letter of James again today. Continuing on with this letter, I said last week that I'm absolutely convinced that 4 months of preaching through this letter has been designed to prepare us for such a time as this. And every time I open this letter, I encounter once again something that is extraordinarily relevant to the moment that we're in. It's quite amazing, to borrow a word. It surprises me. I didn't really expect it to be the case, but it is. So we continue our examination of the first part of James 2. James chapter 2, the first 13 verses, as you remember, is a continuation of the thought of verses 26 and 27 of the previous chapter, where James is talking about what it means to be properly religious. To be properly religious. And James is giving in these 13 verses another example of religious inconsistency. In this case, specifically, showing partiality towards those in a socioeconomic position higher than others. The rich, if you will. Showing deference to them. Showing favoritism to them. And James defines this idea in the first four verses, and then in verses 5 to 7, he gives three reasons why he thinks this particular thing is sinful. Why it is sinful for Christians to favor or put deference towards certain individuals in their assemblies. Number one, it's religiously inconsistent in claiming that salvation is only by faith and then turning around and granting deference to some based on a different standard. That's an inconsistent religion. Secondly, it dishonors the poor man, because the poor man comes into the assembly with the same righteous robes as the rich man does. To make deference to the rich man is to ignore then the nature of the poor man and his righteousness before God in favor of outward robes. That's a very inconsistent religion, by not recognizing that both men are identical in the eyes of God. And then thirdly, it perverts the message of the church by claiming that there's a double standard, another standard by which mercy is applied in the church. A standard in which we say, well, this person, this wealthy person, gets more position and favor because, well, that's how the world works, and so that's how God must work. Well, that's inconsistent. That's not how God works. That's not what the gospel message of Jesus Christ is all about. It's taking a standard from the world, which is inconsistent with Christ, and applying it in the church. And it sends a message to the rest of the world. Well, look, just how you operate out there is the way we operate in the church. It's inconsistent in a number of specific ways. And James therefore says it is sinful. So then, starting in verse 8, James tells us what the cure is. I'm putting that in scare quotes. The cure. What is the cure for this? And the answer to that is exactly the same answer that he gives all the way through what we've seen so far in this letter. And that answer is this: be what you are. Live out your true nature. Be consistent in what you are. How does God see the believer? You should act consistently with how God sees you. You should act consistently as you look into the mirror. Remember that illustration. You look into the mirror, you see. What do you see? Do you see the outward man that's sinful, or do you see what God sees? He sees a man that he's declared to be righteous in his sight by virtue of faith in Christ. If that is how God sees us, then that's how we are to act, because that is what our nature is. We have been, as believers, born again to live out a new nature. A nature that is characterized by what James refers to in verse 8 as the royal law. Now, I spent some time last week defining this royal law a bit, talking about the great commandment and how Jesus applies it in Deuteronomy 6:5 and Leviticus 19:8. But in summary, the royal law is simply the cream that rises to the top. Take all of the law of God spread out through all of the Torah, and what bubbles to the top of that, what comes and rises to the top, the spirit of that, the cream, is this royal law. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus himself, that's the greatest commandment. That summarizes the whole thing. This is what it means. This is what it means to do the law of God. It's the cream that rises to the top. to love God with everything we have and love others selflessly. Now, that leads us then to a question. Okay, how does this royal law then that he refers to apply to this particular sin of partiality? How does it apply to this idea of favoritism? What does it mean to live out this royal law in relation to those around us, particularly those in different classes? Because that's what this partiality problem is, right? It's different classes of people. So how do we live out this royal law in that way? Okay. So now let's explore what James is saying. This is another example, and I know I've said this before, but it's worth repeating. It's always worth repeating. It is important to read the Bible carefully. Very often we have a tendency just to sort of read it, skim over it real fast, assume we know what it's saying and move on. And the problem with that very often is we skim over it, assume know what it's saying, and then we build a theology on the skimmed over version of Scripture, which is inappropriate. We must read carefully. And that is true here. We must read this verse carefully, and we will note something interesting in it. Let me note for you that verse 8 is more complex than a simple reading affords. At first glance, this looks like it's really easy, but there's an important word here that you mustn't miss. All right, so let me read the verse then with an emphasis on that particular word, and hopefully you'll see where we're going. Verse 8 then, James 2, verse 8. If you really fulfill the royal law, according to the Scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you are doing well. Now, you'll notice the word that I hit. I hit the word fulfill here. James says that believers are to fulfill the royal law. Now, notice, he doesn't say obey the law. Okay? He doesn't say obey the law. He doesn't say attempt to keep the law. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say, do your best to love your neighbor. If you really do your best to love your neighbor, you'll be doing well. If you really obey the law, you'll be doing well. If you really try to keep the law, you will do it. No. He doesn't say that. He uses a word here that's much more significant than just the word obey. What he says is fulfill. And that's a much more complex concept than just obey. The word itself in the Greek is the word teleo, T-E-L-E-O, teleo. It is a word that might perk up your ears if you've been trained in deep theological circles. If you've gone to seminary, for example, you might be aware of this word. It is a word that is used a number of times in the New Testament. You find it in a number of places in the New Testament, so we know what this word means. It's translated like complete, or finish, or accomplish, or keep, in the sense of getting all the way to the end of something, to perform all that's contained within something, to end or reach an end to something, or even perfect is one way that the word is used. Now, here's what's fascinating. Paul uses this word in Romans 13:6. And we translate it as pay. And in the context, Paul says, pay your taxes. Okay? And he means pay here, not in the sense of just write a check and pay your taxes. What he means is fulfill the obligation associated with the idea of paying taxes in order that what you are doing fulfills what government is attempting to accomplish by taxing you. Now, that's a really long definition of a word. But that's how he's understanding it. It's not just do something. It's complete something, accomplish something, fulfill it, meaning come to its purpose. In fact, Jesus uses the same word, teleo, when he describes paying the taxes in Matthew 17:24, when he says, go down, says to Peter, go down, get the fish, and you'll find a coin, and when you find the coin, pay the tax. The same word. Teleo. It's about accomplishing something. Literally, what this word means is to complete the purpose of the law. To complete the intention of the royal law. Not just to try and obey it. but to actually fulfill it in such a way to be the law as such, born to be the law. Okay, so it's not just, here's a law externally, tick it off, right? Get a clipboard out, check off when you fail, check off when you succeed. That's not what he means. He means, do this because this is what you are. This is what you are. Now, you remember a moment ago I said that there might be some whose ears perked up when I mentioned this word teleo, because in theological circles, there is something known as the teleological argument for the existence of God. The teleological argument, notice that word teleo is embedded there, the teleological argument for the existence of God. The first part of the teleological argument, the first thesis of it goes like this. The universe, as we know it, is simply too complex to be the result of natural processes putting it together as such. It has what we call an irreducible complexity. There are certain things that are so complex they cannot be reduced into component parts. They simply are. They're complex by virtue of their nature. And the universe is so complex, the systems of the various physical systems, all the complexness of the various physical systems like energy and gravity and light, the physical constant, biological systems and so forth, are far too complex for life, particularly human life, to simply form naturally in this universe. It's simply too complex for the idea of a sentient, intelligent, rational, volitional, emotional, communicative creature to suddenly evolve in such a world. It's simply too complex. It doesn't make any sense. Thus, the first part of the teleological argument is that there must be a designer behind this complexity. Now, I prefer the word creator, as you'll see in a minute, but there must be a designer. The teleological argument was explained by a man of the name of William Paley, who came up with an illustration that best fits this. It might help you understand this a bit better. It's called the watchmaker illustration. Imagine that you land on planet Earth, and you've never been here before. You know nothing about this planet at all. And you are walking along the beach, and in the sand, you discover a device. We'll call it a watch. We know it, but you don't know what it is. You pick it up, you begin to look at it, but you have no idea what it is. But you begin to examine it. You begin to examine all of it. You realize that it's made out of various metals and plastics and glass, and then you open the back and you discover there are gears and springs and pins inside, and you're looking at this device and you realize you see its complexity. Now, what do you assume at this point? Do you just assume then that the forces of this world that you just landed on, that you know nothing about, the natural forces in the world around you, all converge together at this particular moment in time to produce this particular device that you happen to pick up on the beach? And of course the answer is no. It's preposterous. You would make the automatic assumption as an objective observer that this thing must have a designer. It must have somebody who designed it and fabricated it, who made it, because it's impossible for it to have simply appeared. Its complexity argues for a watchmaker. That's why it's called the watchmaker argument. It argues for someone who has created it by designing it and then fabricating it. Thus, an objective examination of the universe, an objective examination of the universe and everything in it, including life, assumes and argues for the existence of a designer. The universe is simply too complex for there to be any other decision that you would come to. Now, I realize that the evolutionists will then immediately jump into the room at this point and say, wait a minute, if you simply insert enough time into the equation, then you can get that to happen. If you simply include enough time, in other words, if you just allowed all the natural processes to go over a long enough period of time, somewhere, somehow, at some point, a watch would evolve on a beach somewhere. The evolutionist would argue that the insertion of time into the equation. But the reason why he does so is because he can't be an objective observer. He is fallen. Human beings are corrupted by sin. Therefore, their minds do not have the ability to be objective observers. We must never forget this, by the way. All the so-called experts, no matter what subject they're talking about, are not objective. They're all fallen creatures who are having to look at the data through the lens of their own corrupted minds and hearts. You must never assume that some talking head on the TV is an absolute expert on every subject and is absolutely neutral in his observations. He cannot be, because he is a fallen creature. It makes it impossible. Sin makes it impossible for man to be an objective observer. And by the way, just as an aside, those of you who might be interested, this is the reason why I think most types of evidential apologetics fail. When I say evidential apologetics, I mean show people the evidence and they should come to the conclusion there is a God. Why does it never produce the result? Because their minds and hearts are not able to observe the evidence in a way that would lead them to the conclusion that there is a God who has sent his son into the world to die for sinners. They would not come there. So the first part of this teleological argument is the universe is simply too complex for there to be anything other than a designer. But the teleological argument doesn't end there. There's a second thesis within it, and this is the more important of the two. Imagine now that you are this same creature, the same person who has found this watch on the beach, and you begin to examine it. And so you begin to observe it, and you begin to notice something. You notice that the little, what we'll call hands on the, what we'll call face of this device seem to be moving. They seem to be moving. One of the three little levers seems to be moving faster than the others, and then there's a second one that seems to be moving a little slower than that, but it's moving. And then there's a third one, a small little hand, that moves very, very slowly, but you can observe it moving. If you just leave the watch sit there for a while, after a while you'll notice that that little hand has moved to a new place. You can't observe it, but you can see that it's moving, quote unquote. But then you make another observation. You notice that these little arms going around and around on this device seem to line up with the movement of the sun through the sky. In fact, you make an interesting observation. You notice that at the point that the sun hits the horizon on one rotation of the earth, as you're observing it, and then the next time the sun appears on the horizon in the same direction, that the little hand on this device is in exactly the same place, even though it has made two full revolutions around the face to get there. So you make an observation. And what's your observation? This device had a designer, but the designer gave it a purpose. The designer gave it a reason for its existence. It's not just a random device that's complex that does nothing. It does something. It seems to have a purpose. So the second part of the thesis of the teleological argument is that the existence within intelligent, rational, sentient life, that is us, of purpose and meaning argues for the existence of a creator who not only designed these complex systems, but gave them a reason to exist. He gave them meaning to exist. Thus, the existence of purpose within human beings strongly argues for the nature of a creator who established such purposes in himself, because he created it to have purpose, and outside of us. Think about it. The watchmaker designed the watch to have purpose for whom? For himself. He created it for himself. Now, yes, he could have also given it to someone else, but in any case, he gave it purpose that extends from himself. He designed it so that the little hands going around in the face have some purpose for him. So the existence of purpose within us strongly argues for the idea that God established a universe and established it with purpose. Not just random existence, but with purpose. Now let's pause for a moment here and see how this works itself out. You will note that the secularist, three generations of people who've grown up in public education, right? The secularist denies that life has any transcendental meaning. I mean, secularism, by its very nature, based on an evolutionary model and worldview, argues that there is really no meaning to our existence. We don't have any meaning. We are nothing more than the random accident of biological mutation that has taken place over millions of years of time. Therefore, by definition, we don't have any purpose. We simply are born, we eat and breathe, we consume resources, and we die. And that's it. That's the evolutionary mind frame. That's the evolutionary model. Therefore, by extension, there's no purpose there. What is the purpose? Well, according to the secularist, there is no transcendental purpose. Yet, we find these same secularists contradicting themselves in situations where life itself is threatened. They find themselves having to defend the life of other creatures who they don't believe have any purpose. That doesn't make any sense, does it? Well, it does from a Christian worldview. I find it fascinating that in the defense of the vulnerable in a pandemic, the old, right? Those who are old, those who have heart disease or other systemic issues in their health, they are the ones most vulnerable in a pandemic. Isn't it interesting that in the defense of the vulnerable in a pandemic, normally strong evolutionists suddenly become pro-life? Have you noticed that? Suddenly become pro-life. They're marching around now with the exact same placards that the protesters in abortion clinic are using. Every life has value. Doesn't matter how old you are, that life has value. They've taken it right from the placards that you see in front of an abortion clinic. Why? Because they know in their heart and in their soul that human beings have purpose. We're not going to allow grandma to die from a pandemic because we know that grandma has purpose. Now, she might be 86 years old and well beyond her age in which she can start earning a living. But she still has value and she still has purpose. See, the fact of the matter is that the true evolutionist really ought to say, look, who cares if grandma dies? And the fact of the matter is, let's weed out the surplus population, as Ebenezer Scrooge would say. We don't need them. They're not helping in our society. Let's let them go. But notice what we're doing. Notice what we're doing. We are willing to destroy an entire economy. And every form of happiness that we've been pursuing for decades in order to save the vulnerable. Have you noticed that? That's exactly what they're doing. They're out there destroying everything about a nation in order to save the most vulnerable. Why? Well, I know why. And the reason why is because they know there is purpose in the life of human beings. Evolution says there's not, but they know there is. And that's the teleological argument at its most foundational point. We all inherently know that the world is complex because there is a designer, and we know there is purpose in everything because there is a designer. Think about it like this, too, that the synergist. Who's the synergist? Well, the synergist is the vast majority of people who go to Christian churches today, who believe that fundamentally the gospel is God offers you salvation, it's up to you to take it. Okay, that's the synergist. Okay, that's what's going on in virtually every church in America except us Reformed people. They imply, listen, the gospel that they preach and the theology that they teach implies that suffering has no meaning because everything is up to us as free will creatures. Oh, so you're having suffering in your life? Well, que sera, sera. That's what happens. That's how it goes. There's no transcendent purpose in what God has. No, there's no decree of God in which God has established who he's going to save and how he's going to do it in the world. No. That's up to us. That's our free will to decide, you see. And yet you find these same synergists at home, and what are they doing? What are they doing right now? They're praying. They're begging God to intervene. Now, if I were God speaking to the synergists, I'm not. You should be thankful for that. If I were God speaking to the synergists, I'd say, why are you calling me? You've been telling me for centuries that it's all about your free will and not what I'm supposed to do, so you're on your own. Que sera, sera. Right? No. The fact of the matter is that we know from a biblical perspective, from a reform perspective, that all things have purpose. I asked this question last week. I'll repeat it again. Is this pandemic a scourge by God upon the earth to awaken the church such that it seeks a new normal for how it disciples its people, particularly in the face of difficulty? Could it very well be that this is God's way of saying to the church, you've been spending way too much time entertaining your people. Start discipling your people. You've been spending way too much time helping your people feel comfortable in their rich world. And I've taken all that away. Now I want you to teach them what it means to live in a world where you have to suffer. Because you haven't prepared your people at all for that. Is that maybe the reason why God has put this? I don't know. I'm not a prophet. I'm not the son of a prophet. And God hasn't spoken to me on the subject. But nonetheless, it seems reasonable as we look into the scriptures that the Bible makes it clear that God sends plagues in order to communicate something. And what did he communicate to the people of Egypt with the plagues? I am God. That was the message. Why did he keep hardening Pharaoh's heart? So that Pharaoh would know that I, the Lord, am God. That I, Yahweh, am the Lord. That was the message. Maybe that's exactly the point that's being made today. Listen, the teleos of human life, the teleos, the purpose, the fulfillment of human life is its purpose. And such purpose is given by a creator. From a reform perspective, I call it a biblical perspective. We would argue that all things have purpose. And this purpose is established by God the Creator in eternity past to glorify Himself. It's hard for us to look around at what's happening to us today as we're huddling in our homes trying to stay safe from a pandemic. It's hard for us to look out and say, God is glorifying Himself in that. It's hard to do that. But that is what the Bible teaches. God is using all things to glorify Himself. By creating, sustaining, redeeming, regenerating, indwelling, and sending a people into a fallen world, now get this, to imitate Him. God's decree and purpose from before the foundation of the world, the teleos, of human existence is for God to create a people and to sustain that people and to redeem that people and to regenerate that people and to indwell that people and then send that people out. And what is he sending them out to do? He's sending them out to imitate himself as the one true God. Now back to James 2. What does all that have to do with James 2? Well, you should have it by now. James uses the word teleo here instead of obey to imply that believers, those who have been regenerated by the Spirit of God, exist to complete the purposes of the royal law. Not just to keep it, but to complete the purpose of it. Why did God give a law? And the answer to that question is, that's its purpose. Now remember, the royal law, this royal law James is talking about, we talked about it as the great commandment, right? It is, in a sense, I've already mentioned this, but I'll repeat it, is a summation of the Mosaic Code, is it not? It's a summation of the two tablets of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. Take the first four commandments, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Take the last six commandments and love your neighbor as yourself. It's a summation of the moral code. But how many times have I said, over the course of my time here at Grace Fellowship, how many times have I said that the law is a reflection of the nature of God himself? Right? I mean, right at the beginning of Exodus 20, when he starts to speak of the Ten Commandments, he starts to give the Ten Commandments. What's the first words out of his mouth? What's the first thing God says? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Therefore, you shall have no other gods before me. In other words, he is saying is, I am this law. You keep this law not because I've just given you something to obey. I've given you this law because it's me. It's my very nature as God himself. I mean, think about it. Why don't we murder? Well, because God is the source of all life. Why don't we commit adultery? Because God is faithful to his people. Why do we not steal? Because God is the owner of all things. Why do we not bear false witness? Because God is truth. Why do we not covet? Because God loves himself more than anything else, and so should we. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The reason we don't do these things and the reason why God prohibits them is not because he's trying to screw us into a corner of things we're supposed to do, but rather to demonstrate his own nature as God. A nature he has put in us. We are, remember, we are, think about this, predestined to be conformed to the image of Christ. What does predestined mean? It means to be given the purpose of. You have been predestined as followers of Christ to imitate this Jesus. This Jesus was the ultimate law keeper, wasn't he? Wasn't he? He walked around this earth with no sin. Now, was this because Jesus just gritted his teeth every day when he got out of bed and said, I will not sin today? No. Why was Jesus the perfect law keeper? Because he was the law. He was the law. He himself had given it because it was out of his own nature. The Son of God walking around on planet Earth was sinless, not because he was gritting his teeth every day and trying desperately not to sin, but because he himself was holiness. He himself was purity. He himself was every aspect of the law of God. And you'll notice that we are conformed, predestined to be conformed to the image of that one who walked around keeping the law because he was the law. It was his nature to do so. Thus, it is the very nature of the believer, his purpose, to love his neighbor as himself. You fulfill this law. You don't just obey it. You fulfill it. You accomplish it. You perfect it. It's a part of your existence. It's a part of what you are as a follower of Jesus. Now, this is radical, isn't it? Because we've heard all of our lives, well, just, you know, just do your best to keep the law and then you'll make it because God is a God of grace. That ain't biblical. It ain't even close. The biblical picture is you are the law. Therefore, there should be no question about whether you keep it or don't. Because it is the very law that is your nature. So, go to verse 9 then. But, if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. Now, that's a very simple statement in light of all that I just said, right? The bottom line, James says, is listen. Coming back to this issue of partiality, if you show favoritism, deference to the rich, you are committing a sin, you are breaking the law that is inherent within your own nature. It is sinful because it is inconsistent with the purpose of the Christian in relation to the law of God, in relation to the law as the nature of God. When he says you're convicted by it, it means you're rebuked or reproved or better, exposed. Exposed. The law exposes something. What does it expose? It exposes who you are. It doesn't expose what you've done. It exposes who you are. This is why I love the sermon from John Piper so many years ago. I remember it vividly when he preached on Revelation 20 and the judgment of the great white throne. and how all men were brought before him, and the books, plural, books, and I never noticed that. It was one of those examples where I was taught to read the Bible carefully. It says books, plural. What's written in those books are everything that people have done. But what's the point of reading what they have done? In order to figure out who they are. Because their deeds will demonstrate who they are at their nature. Those whose names, those whose deeds written in the books will demonstrate one of two things. Either their name is written in the book or it's not. And that could be deduced by what people do. Showing such deference to the rich, James says, is inconsistent with what it means to love in the way that we are born again to love. It's to be inconsistent with our own nature as one reborn to love the law of God. Now, that leads, unfortunately, to a troubling verse or two. Okay? It's not that troubling, but it appears to be troubling for many people. In verses 10 and 11, James will emphasize the point he's making, and he does so by expressing a transcendent principle, right? What does he say? For whoever keeps the whole law, but fails in one point, has become accountable for all of it. All right? Now that's a transcendent reality. You break one part of the law, you've broken it all. Right? It's like saying, well, I only hit the mirror once with a hammer. Well, oh yeah, you hit it, and it's now broken. It's now worthless. You can't use it anymore. You hit it once. Well, I didn't hit it twice. Well, you hit it once. You broke it. Okay? But here's why this is troubling, and I need to correct something. It has never been the intention of James in this letter, up until now, to argue for how one is justified. Right? Think about this letter. Has James ever come along and argued for how a man is justified before God? What has his assumption been? You are justified by faith. He's never made the argument that you have to do this or do that or the other things, then you'll be right with God. This is not a book about justification. This is not a letter about justification. Contrary to popular belief, that'll be the real issue we'll deal with in the next section, the most popular section of this book. It's not about how to be justified. It's about how one is to live as already having been justified. See the difference? It's a huge difference. You come to this book and say, oh, this is how you're right with God. James goes, no. I'm not writing to unbelievers. I'm not writing to people who are looking for how to be right with God. I'm writing to people who already know this Christ by faith. They've already trusted. Notice, they're already coming into the assembly. They're already assembling together. So he's not writing a treatise on how to be justified. He's writing a treatise on what it means to live as one who is already trusted in Christ, okay? It's very important to make that distinction. I would say it this way. You should not extract these verses as a treatise on why keeping the law will never justify you. Okay, don't extract these verses and say, well, see, James says that you have to keep the law perfectly in order to be justified. Uh-uh. It's not where he's going. That's not the context. They're designed to speak to what it means to live out one's justification. Or let's put it this way. You read verse 10, you might come to a wrong conclusion. James is not arguing here that the sin of partiality causes you to lose your salvation. Right? Fail in one part of the law, boom, you're done. No, that's not what he's saying. He is saying why it is inconsistent for believers to act in such a way given their new nature. If you are a follower of Jesus, it is inconsistent, according to the law, to give deference to some over others. That's not what it means to live out the royal law, okay? You with me? Well, you'll see what I mean in a second. It is inconsistent. All right, here's a principle that comes out of these verses. It is inconsistent for the true follower of Jesus to claim to love God and love others, while at the same time showing deference to rich people over poor people. That's not the royal law. Okay? It's inconsistent to do that. Now, as I mentioned before, I think this is an area of blindness in the early Jewish churches. In 45, this was a carryover from the synagogues. There was that sense in the synagogue that the rich people were more blessed by God, and so the Jews naturally felt, having grown up in that system, that that would also be true in the church, that God was more favoring the people who were wealthy over the people who were poor. And of course, James is coming along and saying, listen, to do that is actually unloving. That's not love. That's unloving. It's the opposite of love when you do that. And in verse 11, what James will do is use a preposterous example to make his point. Remember, I talked about a preposterous example a while ago when we talked about the mirror, right? The preposterous example of looking in the mirror, seeing yourself and walking away and forget what you look like. No, who does that? Okay? Okay, it's a preposterous example designed to drive home a point. Same here. You read verse 11, what does it say? For he who said, do not commit adultery, quote unquote, also said, do not murder, quote unquote. If you do not commit adultery, but do murder, you become a transgressor of the law. In other words, James uses it to drive home the point. The law condemns both murder and adultery. But to stand before God and say, yes, I know I hired a hitman to kill my wife, but I didn't cheat on her, is hypocrisy of the worst kind. Right? I mean, can you imagine a man standing before God and saying that? Yeah, I hired a hitman to kill my wife. I murdered her, but I never cheated on her. So I should deserve some points for that, right? And of course, we would think that's preposterous. We would think that's ridiculous. In fact, most of us would probably categorize the sin of murder to be stronger and more important than the sin of adultery. And so we would, in our crazy mathematics, our religious mathematics, decide, well, such a man is probably worth some brownie points because at least he didn't cheat on her. I mean, he killed her, yeah, but he didn't. Notice the preposterous. What is he trying to do? He is saying, listen, the Christian is to never compromise the law of love. There's no compromise in here for the believer. There's no sense of, well, you know, in our church, we give deference to these rich people. We put the poor people in the back, we put the rich people in the front. But that's okay. God lets us get away with that. It's such a small sin. It's such a trivial thing. God will never really notice that. And James is writing and saying, you're missing the point. The point is that the law of love is such that we should never allow certain behavior, certain sinful behaviors toward others to remain within us. We should flush all of those out in favor of one law, which is the very nature of what we are, which is to love everybody as we love ourselves. The problem with humans, of course, is what do? Well, let's kind of draw some distinctions here, right? Right, okay. So in our church, there are certain things you can do and not do. I mean, I know down in that church they have different rules, but at our church we do this, and then we don't do that, we do this, we don't do that, we do this, we don't do that. And we justify it as, well, this is the best way to do church life. Make some rules up, do this, not do that. Well, guess what it leads to eventually? Well, I give you the Roman Catholic Church as an example. You give me 1,500 years of what they've done, this is what you have. You have a church that's abandoned the gospel of Jesus Christ entirely for sacramentalism. Justification by keeping the sacraments. That's what happens when you compromise this law of love. So we get to verse 12, we get to the command. Remember, this is the book of imperatives. Remember I said there's at least 50 of them in this book? Here's the one for this section. So speak and so act as those who are be judged under the law of liberty. Speak and act as those who live under a different law, who live under a different, I should say it differently, to live under a different nature would be the better way to say that. Remember, I quoted part of this passage a few weeks ago from Romans 7 to make the point. What does Paul say in Romans 7, 6? He says, but now we are released from the law, having died to that which held us captive, so that we may serve in the new way of the Spirit. And not in the old way of the written code. We've been set free from that old law, the written letter that we have to follow. We've been freed from the slavery of checklists, of trying to do this and that and the other thing, to a new law. A law would set us at liberty to truly love others without having to doubt whether we've been successful at it or not. And trying to measure it in some way, because that's what human beings do, right? That's all we have a tendency to do, is measure ourselves. Am I really being merciful or not? Am I really being loving or not? Well, I don't know. We've been set free from those checklists to live in accordance with the nature that is within us. We have been set free, in the last verse, verse 13, we have been set free to show mercy. Notice what he says, for judgment is without mercy to one who has shown no mercy. You see, under the old code, there was no mercy. No mercy. Under the Mosaic Code, when the people gathered at Sinai, there was no mercy established in the law. You did the law or you died. That's the way it worked. You kept the law or you died. There was no mercy. There was no room for mercy. In point of fact, those who are still living under the old code, the reprobate, all who have not been regenerated by the Spirit of God, they're still under the old code. And guess where they're at? They're in a case where there is no possibility of mercy. All they have is judgment and wrath. That's all they have coming. And the reason why is because they were never willing to show mercy themselves. What was their fundamental characteristic? Remember last week when we talked about the rich? They were selfish. They weren't selfless. They weren't worried about others. They were only worried about themselves. The key reality of the reprobate person is that he possesses a nature of utter selfishness. It's all about him. Which is why this pandemic is so really fascinating to watch, because you have a whole society full of people who have been utterly selfish for so long, and now all of that freedom and liberty and happiness has been taken away and they're living in fear and anxiety. It's fascinating to watch it. And I guarantee you in the weeks ahead you're going to see a great deal of fistfights. I don't mean literal fistfights. I mean a lot of politically organized fistfights of how we're going to live in these days. The reprobate have nothing to look forward to but the wrath of God. And if we take Romans 1:18 fairly seriously, for now the wrath of God is being revealed, we might look around and see it literally around us. But the good news is that under the new code, mercy is the key concept. Loving others by showing mercy to them. Mercy triumphs over judgment. The regenerated heart in the man who loves Jesus triumphs over judgment, because mercy is the outflow of a life of love, showing mercy to others. Would you not agree with me that the work of Christ is all about mercy? Isn't it about mercy? Isn't that really what Christ has come to do, to be merciful to us? Because what did we deserve? We deserve wrath. Punishment. Did Jesus need mercy? No. He was the one with the nature perfectly able to keep the law. He stood before God. He could have stood before God and go, I'm fine. I don't know about the rest of those folks. But no, what did he do? He came to give his own life as an act of mercy on behalf of a people who had no possibility of any mercy from God whatsoever. But now this Christ intervenes for them and says to the Father, whoa, 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 stop your wrath against this one. I have purchased his wrath. Therefore, be merciful. Christ is all about mercy. Therefore, the work of the believer is all about mercy. Why? Because we've been predestined to be conformed to the image of this ultimately merciful one. Bringing Christ's mercy to others. Triumphing over all forms of wrath that come over a fallen and rebellious world. What is James trying to say here? Look, very simple. You have been born again by the Spirit of God to be a creature endowed with the very law of God. The very nature of God Himself, His holiness, has been written on your heart. Go and live it. Because that's what you are. There's no compromise or rule setting or rule making or checklist that we ought to be checking off, but rather we should be throwing open our hearts and our arms to people in mercy. And there is, okay, didn't I say this book is relevant? There is no better time in the history of America where mercy is going to be needed. We're only in the beginning of this thing. And we don't know what it's going to look like 6 months from now. I mean, right now we're estimating 30% of the workforce is going to lose their job. And many of those jobs are not coming back. And that may be affecting people in our own congregation. The question is, what are we going to do to be merciful to the people around us? Because that's what we are. Our first reaction, our automatic reaction should be, as those who follow Christ, how am I going to demonstrate who I really am in the midst of this pandemic? What am I going to do? Where's my mercy going to be shown? How do you, as a born-again follower of Jesus, show mercy to others in such a time of great need? How can we be consistent with the nature God has bestowed upon us in Christ by His Spirit? Now, the answer to that question is many and varied. If nothing else, we should be praying for our own people consistently and regularly, checking up on them, looking into their lives to see what we can do to help. We should be contacting people and talking to people. I've had conversations with so many people over the last few weeks and what's going on in their lives. Some I haven't really talked to in a very long time directly, but nonetheless, an opportunity to chat with people about what's going on. These are the kinds of simple things that can be done. But there's other more realistic things even we can do. There's a whole bunch of us in this church who are about to receive a check from Uncle Sam. What are we going to do with that? You know, the Lord has blessed a great number of us that we don't need that money. We don't need that money. What are you going to do with it? Hide it away in a checking account somewhere? Or take it and use it for someone else who might not be as fortunate as you, has not been as blessed as you are? Honor the poor man. Don't show favoritism to the rich man, which might be you. You see, this is what James is saying in this passage. We have been born again to be something different. We have been born again with the very nature of God's law written on our hearts as He's taken out that old rebellious heart and given us a new one, a heart of love. And so James's response to partiality or any sin in the church, go be what you really are. Live out the nature that Christ has put within you. Imitate Him in His nature as you express the love of God, as you show mercy to others. May the Lord grant us such love. And may we express it even in such dark times as these.